and certainly part of your prayer life for all of you. Well, I'll get a garble in here. Well, anyway, the writings of the man stand on their own. He doesn't have to be a flaming symbol of man's fight for freedom to be read. I mean, he's readable, and you'll enjoy him. Even such a subject as cancer ward, how could he pick out a worse one, you'll figure? Or one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. And we're going to try and get that movie here, whatever it may cost us, because that has been put into a movie. The first circle, I think, is the most interesting of the novels, and it's only about 3-4 days through the Christmas season. The Christmas season provides the framework for it, the whole meaning of the Christ and his coming being the background for the dreariness and the dismal kind of enslavement of man's spirit to the state that occurs through here a group of top-grade scientists who are all prisoners put to work on 12-hour schedule, 7 days a week, in order to produce a new kind of a voice mixer, actually, so they can detect, just like they do with your thumbprint, they can detect who you are by the timbre of your voice. And that's what they're working on. It begins by a man in the foreign department of the state having his better instincts get the better of his better judgment, and he warns a person who is a friend of his mother from childhood that they're going to be after him because they want to make a case against him. He was with a foreign delegation, and they believe that while he was with a foreign delegation, he made some kind of contact with a foreign power, this time France, in a friendly way, and maybe telling them something of the results of medical research in his particular area of competence. For this, he was to go to jail because he was allowing the free flow of knowledge, which is not permitted under the Soviet system, any kind of knowledge. And this made him sneak over to a pay booth after he fought it through to call him up in a quick call. The housekeeper of the man refuses to accept the call, even as genuine. Meanwhile, it's already been recorded because all the phones are bugged, and not just certain ones, like in America. Of course, in America, if you're unimportant, you are. And the whole thing, novel, is sort of in the background. Although this man comes into it only occasionally in the novel. The novel actually centers around this particular suburban research area where there are some built-in comforts so they can at least threaten those to be taken from them. But the novel indicates as its general theme that when you've once taken everything from man, you have lost your control over him because you have nothing more to take from him. And what happens when man has had everything taken from him? It's a very exciting novel. It's very good. And some tremendous conversations in it that are worthy of repetition. Today, we're going to go into Solzhenitsyn as the first of the writers in the Lifestyle Enrichment Group that we're taking this year, because he is a significant writer, if not the most significant, of this period in our century, because he helps to restore the perspective of what we call lifestyle enrichment, that it's not something aesthetic, it's not a cultural adornment, but it's an enlistment in the cause of Christ for his kingdom to come and his will to be done on earth. And that's what lifestyle enrichment is about. It's a discipleship training kind of a regime here through the 9 months that you're here. And Solzhenitsyn makes a great introduction to it as far as I am concerned. I mean, you couldn't take a better man to start off with. I think one of the tremendous statements that's made in the book, and that's going to read that first of all because it's the theme of the cancer ward in a sense. And this is the remark of Oreshnikov. He is the retired head of the cancer ward and the present head of the cancer ward. Donsova has come to him for having an examination because she suspects cancer but dare not confront it herself. And though she could look at her own x-rays, she does not. She respects the physician's privilege to tell her what he wants to tell her, and she has this particular interview. It's just one minor portion of the book, but she has to be head of the cancer ward. But as he is conducting the examination, this man who is the retired head of it, he says this. One might have expected the resolute, unyielding Donsova to show more strength in such a trial. She was a woman doctor and more masculine than feminine. Her sudden collapse confirmed Oreshnikov's opinion that modern man is helpless when confronted with death, that he has no weapon to meet it with. And that's the theme sentence of the book, that modern man is helpless when confronted with death, that he has no weapon to meet it with. And the great analogy that's in here is that the exile communities, and they are in millions in Russia, and the labor camps, and again they're in millions in Russia, are the kind of cancer of the body politic. And that what cancer is to you is what they are to the body politic. And that's sort of the overarching imagery behind the book. But its theme is in this one line, that modern man is helpless when confronted with death, that he has no weapon to meet it with. I suppose to show how much the same is true for our own culture, which spends itself in a frenzy of escape from this moment of truth, is this kind of an experience of Norman Hobbles when he wanted to get on records this particular song that he wrote here at Holden Village that's become quite popular throughout the nation. And the recording company really choked on the line, "I want to celebrate my death with all my might, for Christ is changing everything, everything." So, and they simply point blank refused. They couldn't do it. And he says, "You have to, that's the point." But this is what American culture can't face either. How they cannot confront them. We spend all our time escaping from that moment of truth. And yet this tremendous novel shows it comes to us all, and finally to the head of the clinic, of course. And that's why I read from the head of the clinic when it hits her. And cancer comes to her. And the former head of the clinic, whom she asked to examine her, says, "Modern man is helpless when confronted with death, that he has no weapon to meet it with." Now this was really, in all our high-flown language, Rosemary Ruther was trying to get across in the present conversation between the communist world and the Christian world, in which you wanted to use the word transcendental. And Mary said, "Why don't you say death?" And being a professor, she couldn't. She couldn't. She could not get the word death into her own vocabulary, for all her theology is an escape from it, you see. And she could only get back to, no, it has no transcendental reality. It can't confront transcendental. But even she is a person, and it was evident in her talks with us how desperate she was in her own escape from her own death. Roy Harrisville tells about his own writing. He's scared to death. He's going to die before he gets a few more books on the printing press, and how ridiculous it all is he sees for himself. But this sort of an attempt at a kind of human survival in terms of putting so many books into the public eye before you're taken from the scene. And of course, his father died of a heart attack, and he can think this. "I've lived with death all my life. I saw my father die for over 9 years of leukemia, and I realized, I suppose out of that, that the first problem, man, is his own death. And that you don't come alive until you've confronted your own, until you've died, in fact, to come alive in Christ." And that is really Solzhenitsyn's message. It comes out specifically in Cancer Ward in a beautiful way in one of the minor subjects there, whose parents have always been liberals, defending the persecuted labor, and now are very scandalized and offended that her daughter, under the communist regime, identifies with the persecuted Christians. They're the minority now. And she turns Christian because they're the ones whom the state would like to spew out. And this is a very real thing for him. His letter to the Metropolitan of, I believe, last year scolded the church in its submission to the state that they actually refused to baptize his child till he had a permit from the communist authorities to have the child baptized. And this really blew Solzhenitsyn's mind, that the church could allow itself to be that subservient. They wouldn't baptize his child until the state gave a permit.
Yeah, but I think also it should be made aware of the fact there are two churches in Russia. There's the official state church and the underground Orthodox
Church. Oh, yes, this is true. There is an underground, particularly amongst the Baptists, to some extent amongst the Lutherans. As you know, who read Dostoevsky, the Lutheran Church's image in Russia is almost like Unitarians in America. They look at us as kind of a over-abstracted, over-intellectual church who have no passion for Christ. And to some extent, this is only too true of the kind of Lutheran church we had there. It was chiefly a church for the upper-class intellectual, but it wasn't small. And in some areas, it wasn't this. In some area, it was a church for the whole total population, especially for the German Russian. And one of the things that you get out of, this famous Sven Hedin, the Swedish traveler, when he gets up into Turkestan and Indo-Turkestan and comes to what he believes are unvisited villages, practically by Westerners, and they're singing German chorales on a Sunday morning, and he wonders what gives, and here he sees a Lutheran church operating. Well, the typical bureaucracy does things in its usual stupid way. They kill off the pastor and send the whole congregation out in the same freight cars, and on their way out, they elect the deacon to be a pastor, and the church keeps right on functioning. And one of the big problems, incidentally, in foreign missions when I was at the seminary was how to reach these areas. Most of them were nomadic groups. They were difficult to settle. We couldn't learn their tribal dialects. And how were we going to reach them in terms of the proclamation? Well, the Russians took care of that. They just simply took these Lutheran communities and shipped them out intact, practically, out into the area and resettled them. And there is the church operating in the midst of them. And that's, again, how even the devil has to serve Jesus Christ, finally, and especially when we've confronted our own death. Like Jesus says, when all they can do is take your life from you, why fear him? Fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. And unless this finally becomes our fundamental conviction, we are worthless for the proclamation. There are many times when I have not been able to preach a Sunday morning sermon until on Saturday I've taken a walk through the cemetery. And I thought, boy, it ain't long till you're there, brother. And what does it matter what they think tomorrow noon when they've heard the message? You'd better be faithful to what God's laid on your heart. And this is true for all of us. And lifestyle enrichment can't come until you can say with Christ is changing everything, that wonderful song Norman Hobbles, I want to celebrate my death with all my might. In a real sense, that's the theme then of this. Now, rather than talking about it, I want to read from it. And it's really, one could take any number. I have a number of thumbed-down pages here which give you the feel of it. I think I'm going to just take two chapters and read, simply because it gives you a continuity. And right after happy ending, he has one a less bit happy. And I thought maybe we'd have time enough to just get the feel of his style by reading that chapter. It's chapter 34. So the quote I gave you is on page 448, where you get the theme of the book stated by the former head of the cancer clinic, that man is unable to confront his own death because he has no weapon to meet it with. Modern man is helpless when confronted with death. He has no weapon to meet it with. It is time for me too to depart. Like an old man who has outlived his contemporaries and feels a sad inner and emptiness, Kostolotov. And so far as there's a hero in this book, he's it. In a sense, he's like all modern novels. He's kind of an anti-hero, but he is also a hero as well as an anti-hero. Kostolotov felt that evening that the ward was no longer his home. Even though the beds were all occupied and there were the same old patients asking the same old questions again and again as though they'd never been asked before, is or isn't it cancer? Will they cure me or won't they? What other remedies are there that might help? Vadim was the last to leave toward the end of the day. The gold had arrived and he was being transferred to the radiological ward. Oleg was left on his own. Vadim, incidentally, is the one sort of convinced communist and the communist crusader in it. Then you have a communist bureaucrat in it. And the rest are all of them rather indifferent to the whole problem of the state and communism or non-communism. They're fundamentally human beings. Oleg was left on his own to survey the beds, to remember who had originally occupied them and how many of those had died. It turned out that not very many had. It was so stuffy in the ward and warm outside that Kostolotov went to bed, leaving the window half open. The spring air flowed over the windowsill and over him. The fresh, lively sounds of spring could be heard from the little courtyards of the tiny old houses huddled right up against the wall on the other side of the medical center. He couldn't see what was happening in these little courtyards beyond the brick wall, but the sounds were now clearly audible, doors slamming, children yelling, drunks roaring, records screeching, and then after lights out, the deep, powerful voice of a woman singing the lines of a song in anguish or in pleasure, one couldn't tell which. So this young and handsome miner he escorted to her home. She escorted to her home. All the songs were about the same thing. So were the thoughts everyone was thinking. But Oleg needed to divert his mind. On this night of all nights, when he had to get up early and save his energy, Oleg couldn't get to sleep. Been told he can leave the next day. He's an exile, like most of the book patients here are exiles. As they're German nationals who've been sent off into exile in Asia, or they are, for one reason or another, dispossessed of their freedom and sent into exile or into labor camps. Now they are in the cancer ward together, along with some citizens in good status, like the two I mentioned. All these thoughts, idle as well as important, kept running through his head. The unresolved argument, Rusinov's the bureaucrat who's been sending everybody into exile. The thing Shlubovim hadn't got around to saying him. Shlubovim is the man for whom Christianity's become real. And he's really concerned because he realizes there's that part of man that the state can never own and which life or death itself is finally subject to. That part of him which is eternal, which belongs to God. And that's what he's contending for. That's Shlubovim. The points he should have made during his talks with Vadim, that's the convinced communist. The head of the murdered beetle, that's a dog, that they just went out and shot all the dogs in the town. The faces of the cadmans animated in the yellow light of the paraffin lamp as he described to them his million impressions of the town. They told him the news of the owl and what concert they'd heard on the radio while he'd been away. The three of them would feel as if that little low hut contained the whole universe. Some beautiful lines in here how this happens, how just you can find some kind of retreat security from the state all encroaching and from its continual spies around you in the simplicity and the fact that you've got nothing but three boxes and a place to lay your head. The clothes you have are patched, holy, but at least you are your own. And that's the way, incidentally, the book ends, too, just in that. The three of them would feel as if that little low hut contained the whole universe. He lay there imagining the supercilious, absent-minded look on the face of 18-year-old Enos Broom, whom Oleg would now not dare to approach. His treatment has robbed him, incidentally, of not the libido, he still has sexual desire, but the drugs you've taken have taken it all from him. It happens in our society, too. And those two invitations to spend the night from two different women, one of them a young doctor and the other one an older doctor. It was something new for him to track his brains about. How was he supposed to interpret them? The icy world which had shaped Oleg's soul had no room for unpremeditated kindness. He had simply forgotten that such a thing existed. Again and again this comes up. Shlubovim incidentally has the same theme of Kurt Vonnegut Jr. in his thought, that the one thing that life permits us and that we can have is mutual affection. And why not give it? Why let the state take it from us? Mutual affection. Uncritical affection. And here you have unpremeditated kindness as his word for it. And this is what makes it great literature. It's in this context. He'd simply forgotten that such a thing existed. Simple kindness seemed the most unlikely explanation of their having invited him. What did they have in mind, and what was he expected to do? He had no idea. Turned from side to side, then back again, while his fingers kept rolling an invisible cigarette. Oleg got up and dragged himself out for a walk. The landing was in half darkness by the door. Sivgatov was sitting as usual in the tub, struggling to save his saccharum. He was patient and hopeful, and all hopelessness had cast its spell over him. Sitting at the duty nurse's table with her back to Sivgatov was a short, narrow-shouldered woman in a white coat bending under the lamp. She wasn't one of the nurses, though. Tonight was Turgum's night for duty, and presumably he was already asleep in the conference room. It was a remarkable, well-mannered orderly who wore glasses, Elizaveta Antalyevna. She had managed to complete all her jobs for the evening and was sitting there reading. I'm taking this section because you're just telling me about this in the ordinary course of a conversation, and this is the society, this is the culture he's describing. One that's impossible, I think, for most of us to even in any way realize or actualize in our own imagination. And that's why I want to read it. During the 2 months Oleg had spent in the hospital, this plain-taking orderly with a quick, intelligent expression had often crawled under their beds to wash the floor while they lay above her. She would always move Kostolov's, I'm going to say just K because it's quicker, always move K's boots, which he kept secretly in the dark depths under his bed, carefully to one side and never cursed him for it. Wasn't allowed to have it, but he managed to sneak him in so he could take walks out of the hospital and escape from that kind of a prison. She wiped the wall panels, cleaned the spittoons, and polished them until they shone. She distributed jars with labels to the patients. Anything heavy, inconvenient, or dirty that the nurses are not supposed to touch, she had to carry to and fro. I should say even at this time, maybe, that it's a good book to read, if nothing else. This might happen to you, and it's good for you not to be too taken by rules and the kind of authority you'll be there when you do. There are always ways to beat it. And you should always find them. I mean, it's part of your duty. I mean, I've been here, and I know. And some of this, you'll help me. No, it is. It's part of your duty. My first function in our prison camp was to keep my wife and daughter alive, and it was difficult for my wife to see this. She couldn't see it. She definitely couldn't. For instance, we supplied the milk for all the babies born in the camp and the layettes for all the babies born in the camp, whereas Mary never had it for mine, which was ridiculous. Finally, I got hold of 2 goats, and then those 2 goats I had, and I could trade their milk for other things necessary for Marn and Mary to stay alive. My duty was to them, first and foremost, and not simply to see that everybody in our prison camp ended up like that, with us, with nothing left to barter. We were left helpless. The Jews came in, they kept everything they brought in. They didn't put a thing into the common larder. And others at least kept out something, not us. We were Christians. Everything went into the common larder. This was stupid, and it cost Mary her health and Marn almost her life. And it's something we have to recall. Got to live in the world the way it is. As I told Mary, her problem, she'd always had a father who'd been fighting the world the way it was for her. And though I'd had to fight off my mother, I didn't always fight her off enough, because she was always willing to go to bat for me, too. And we were both of us too idealistic. This you cannot be, and this book will show you this. It's a good book for that. If nothing else, to read that and get a healthy idea of this. Even in the village once in a while, remember this when you go up there at night. Don't worry about taking things out. They're there for you. And they're there to keep you happy in between meals. So it's true, we get fed so well, we don't get so hungry between. The more uncomplainingly she worked, the less notice they took of her in the wing. As the 2,000-year-old saying goes, you can have eyes and still not see. This is, you see, it doesn't say the Bible. It doesn't say anything like that. He wants this published in Russia. And he hoped it would be. As the 2,000-year-old saying goes, you can have eyes and still not see. But a hard life improves the vision. There were some in the wing who immediately recognized each other for what they were. It's a beautiful statement earlier about the same woman. It's a very minor character. She only comes once before. But if anybody else is willing to do it, let them do it. And since she was willing, okay, she went the 3rd mile where others didn't even walk the 1st half. And it's the story in any kind of a community that can easily happen. But a hard life improves the vision. There were some in the wing who immediately recognized each other for what they were. Although in no way distinguished by uniform, shoulder insignia, or armband, they could still recognize each other easily. It was as if they bore some luminous sign in their foreheads or stigmata on their feet and palms. In fact, there were plenty of clues, a word dropped here and there, the way it was spoken, a tightening of the lips between words, a smile while others were serious or while others laughed. The Uzbeks in the car, Kalpaks, had no difficulty in recognizing their own people in the clinic, nor did those who had once lived in the shadow of barbed wire. This is a very interesting thing, how there's sort of a underground sort of fraternity of different kinds. Those who have been in exile together, those who have been in labor camp. And this is also a very real thing in that kind of society. Kay and Elizabeth Antoliana had long ago recognized each other, and since they'd always greeted, and since then they'd always greeted one another understandingly. There'd never been a chance for them to have a talk, though. Oleg walked up to her table, slapping with his slippers so as not to alarm her. "Good evening, Elizaveta Antoliana." She was reading without glasses. She turned her head in some indefinable different way from usual, ready to answer the call of duty. "Good evening." She smiled with all the dignity of a lady of a certain age receiving a welcome guest under her own roof. Agreeably and without hurry, they regarded one another. Their look meant they were always ready to give one another help, but there was no help either of them could give. Oleg inclined his shaggy head to get a better view of the book. "Another French one, is it?" he asked. "What is it?" "Claude Ferrari," replied the strange orderly, pronouncing the L softly. "Where did you get all these French books?" "There's a foreign language library in town, and there's an old woman I borrow them from, too." "Why, all is French?" "Like looking like a dog, bird dog might look," he says about it. The crow's feet around her eyes and lips revealed her age, her intelligence, and the extent of her suffering. "They don't hurt you so much," she answered. Her voice was never loud. She enunciated each word softly. "Why, for your pain," Oleg objected. It was hard for him to stand for any length of time. She noticed this and pulled up a chair. "How many years is it? For the last 200 years, I suppose, we Russians have been owing and aying. Paris, Paris, it's enough to burst your eardrums," Kay growled. "We're supposed to know every street, every little cafe bar. Just to be spiteful, I don't want to go to Paris at all." "Not at all," she laughed, and he laughed with her. "You'd rather be in exile?" They laughed identically, a laugh which began, but then seemed to trail off. "It's true, though," grumbled Kay. "They're always twittering, blowing themselves up to rages, and going in for trivial repartee. Makes you want to take them down a peg or two and ask them, 'Hey, friends, how would you make out at hard labor? How would you do on black bread without hot food, eh?' That's not fair. I mean, they managed to avoid black bread, and deservedly so." "Well, maybe. Maybe I'm just jealous, but I still want to put them down." He was shifting from side to side as he sat there. It was as though his body was too tall and a burden to him. Making no attempt to bridge the gap, he suddenly asked her easily and directly, "Was it because of your husband or you yourself?" She answered at once and as straightforwardly as if he was asking her about tonight's duty. It was the whole family. As for who was punished because of whom, I haven't any idea. In most cases, they have no idea why they're punished or for. There's been some anonymous kind of accusation, and this one man that was mentioned earlier has been making many of them. And now, as the thaw comes and some of them are coming back, he's scared to death because some of them have been outright lies in order for him to get somebody else's job, or even in one case, the furniture of an apartment to themselves, and the whole apartment not have to share, and so on. It was the whole family. She says, "Are you all together now?" "No, my daughter died in exile. After the war, we moved here, and they arrested my husband for the second time. They took him to the camps. And now you're alone? I have a little boy, he's 8. Oleg looked at her face. It hadn't trembled with pity. "Why should it? It was a purely business-like conversation." "The second time was in 49, was it?" he asked her. "Yes, as one would expect. Which camp?" "Tyshet Station." Again, Oleg nodded. "I know." He says, "That'll be Camp Lake. You might be right up the Lena River, but the postal address is Tyshet." "You've been there, have you?" she asked, unable to restrain her hope. "No, I've only heard about it. Everyone bumps into everyone else." "His name's Zarki. You haven't met him. You never met him anywhere?" She was still hoping. He must have met him somewhere. He'd tell her about him. "Dzarsky." Oleg smacked his lips. "No, he hadn't met him. He can't meet everyone." "He's allowed 2 letters a year," she complained. Oleg nodded. "It was the old story. Last year was only one in May. I have had nothing since then." Look, she was hanging on a single thread of hope. She was only a woman after all. "It doesn't mean anything, Kostolov," Kay explained confidently. "Everyone's allowed 2 letters a year, you know, and you know how many thousands that makes. The censors are lazy. At Spass camp, when his prisoner was checking the stoves during the summer, he found a couple of 100 unposted letters in the censor's office stove. They'd forgotten to burn them. Post office was blown up by our men in Manila, and all our letters were out on the street for over 3 years. We've gotten none. All of them. There's been no word whatever permitted. One little Christmas card came through one time written by a cousin of mine without even a word about my family, sent out as an official greeting from the ALCW. It's like even the devil was working for him. Yeah. That was just his way of giving. That was our one word in 38 months almost. We didn't know whether Judy's boyfriend was still faithful to her. He was. They're married now. We didn't know whether our family's still alive. No. Not a word. All the letters were down the Manila post office and bothered to deliver them. And that's the nature of it. They don't just from cruelty, like he says. Not just cruelty, the censors are lazy. We want to read through always, see if there's anything we shouldn't hear. Don't bother delivering. Then you don't get any trouble for not delivering them. You might get in trouble if you did. Who wants to get in trouble? They'd forgotten to burn them. Didn't bother to burn them. In this case, they didn't bother to destroy them. Just left them down there. When our boys blew up the post office there, they were all over the streets. He'd done his best to explain it gently. It'd been going on for so long, she ought to be accustomed to it by now. But she was still looking at him in that wild, terrified way. Surely people should eventually cease to be surprised at anything, and yet they continue to be. See? I mean, this is the taken-for-granted mood of these books. Surely people should eventually cease to be surprised at anything, and yet they continue to be. I mean, that once in a while there is a break in the bleakness ought to be your surprise, not that it's bleak. You mean your son was born in exile? She nodded. And now you have to bring him up on your own salary. No one will give you a skilled job. They hold a record against you every year. You live in some hovel. They were framed as questions, but there was no element of curiosity in his questions. Also clear, clear enough to make you sick. Elizaveta Antonievna's small hands, worn off from the everlasting washing of floor cloths and the boiling water and covered in bruises and cuts, were now resting on the little book, soft, covered and printed in small, graceful format on foreign paper, the edges a bit ragged from being cut many years ago. If only living in a hovel was my only problem, she said. Trouble is, my boy's growing up. He's clever and he asks about everything. How ought I bring him up? And this is why I'm reading it for these special 2 pages, because it's just right down with it. When you give in to the lie enters into everything. You think you can finally make a some place apart from the lie, where you can have security and bring up your own apart from it. It isn't possible. And that's what this book shows so well. There's no escape from the time that you let the lie reign. This is one thing Watergate's trying to say to us, and don't get bored about it. When you say that's only human nature after all, like the white paper on our occupation troops in Russia, General Clay started the introduction by saying it's only human nature after all that our occupation troops acted like they did. Think of all the black babies who left behind, just as one small item as a proof of our occupation being what it was. And the review of it simply said, it simply shows that when you say it's only human nature after all, what you have happen is something very subhuman. When you say that's the way all armies are? The trouble is, my boy's growing up. He's clever and he asks about everything. How ought I to bring him up? Should I burden him with the whole truth? The truth enough to sink a grown man, isn't it? It's enough to break your ribs. Or should I hide the truth and bring him to terms with life? Is that the right way? What would his father say? And would I succeed? After all, a boy's got eyes of his own. He can see. Burden him with the truth, declared Oleg confidently, pressing his palm down on the glass tabletop. He spoke as though he brought children up himself, as though he had never made a single slip. She propped up her head, cupping her temples in her hands, which were tucked under her headscarf. She looked at Oleg in alarm. He had touched a nerve. It's so difficult bringing up a son without his father, she said. A boy constantly needs something to lean on, an indication where to go, doesn't he? And where is he to get from that from? I'm always doing the wrong thing, doing this or doing that when I shouldn't. Oleg was silent. It wasn't the first time he'd heard this point of view, but he couldn't understand it. That's why I read old French novels. But only during night duty, by the way. I have no idea whether these Frenchmen were keeping silent about more important things, or whether the same kind of cruel life as ours was going on outside the world of their books. I have no knowledge of the world, and so I read in peace. Like a drug? A blessing, she said, turning her head. It was like a nun's in that white headscarf. I know of no books closer to our life that wouldn't irritate me. Some of them take the readers for fools, others tell no lies. Our readers take great pride in that achievement. They conduct deep research into what country lane a great poet traveled along in the year 1800, and something, or what lady he was referring to on page so-and-so. This is just what happened in our Lutheran church when it refused to confront truth. You'll get great scholarship of a certain kind coming from Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, I can assure you, in the next generation. You gotta do something with your brain, and when you don't dare say it ain't so, then you do something else with it, see? And you can have great kind of scholarship, says, of a certain kind. It's the kind of lie, again, the lie. What scholarship, unless it deals with truth that's now and not with footnotes that are then.